Well, that was beautiful, Naya and Emil. Thank you for that. And those words, to be fully loved and known by God is an amazing thing. Fits so well with what we're talking about today. So this is now part three of four on our series on Cherish. In part two that we just covered, the first 2 points of today's greater message. I want to continue to go through that. And so we're going to move now to point number three. Point number three is notice your spouse. Notice your spouse. Now, if you want a book to read on this subject, if you want to study it, there's a very well-known book with the title Cherish. It's written by Gary Thomas. It's a book that I've studied on this topic, and it's very useful, and it kind of launched me into this topic, and I've then studied other individuals since then. But he tells a story that I think brings out this notice your spouse moment pretty well. He talks about sitting behind a couple at church, a husband and wife sitting along next to each other, and right next to the husband is one of his good male friends. And so as the message and sermon is going on, every time the pastor would say something that was funny, was insightful, she would turn to her husband just as he would turn to look at his best friend, and he would share this moment, this laugh, this part of the message with his friend. And this went on about five or six times where she would turn to look at him and he would turn to look at his friend. And after about five or six times, the wife stopped even trying to look at him to connect, to have this moment. And he said that she would just stare straight ahead and that the expression on her face could have frozen Mercury. But still, the husband didn't notice. He was having a fantastic time sharing these moments with his guy friend next to him. And this is just one example. This scenario actually comes up quite often, even in marriage counselings or relationship counselings, premarital counseling, where somebody gets invited along to go with friends, and that friend's having a great time with his friends, but the other one feels kind of invisible. Every time there's the moment in the big game or there's something that's happening, they're sharing it with their buddies. And all these individuals would tell you the same thing. I don't mind them having friends, but why'd you invite me along? Or why did she invite me along if she didn't want to share the moment with me, right? Or he didn't want to share the moment with me. And I think all of us, that makes sense to us, that scenario. The spouse felt alone, perhaps invisible. They certainly didn't feel cherished. In this story I just shared about the couple sitting in front of Gary Thomas, in his story, why was the wife angry, or upset? It was because she didn't feel cherished. She wanted to share the sermon, the message, the moments of life alongside her best friend that was right next to her. And whether he did it intentionally, which I doubt, most likely unintentionally, he shared it those moments with a buddy instead. Now, the husband could logically think, you're being unreasonable. I'm just sitting next to a friend. I just shared these moments of friend. You don't want me to have other friends. And, again, of course, it's not about having other friends. It's not about a hobby. It's not about video games. It's not about sports. It's about being cherished or being invisible. She wanted to be cherished. The issue is about honor. The issue is about being noticed. If we want to have a spouse that feels cherished, we have to keep noticing them. And it's examples like that from the book that made me have to take a step back in my marriage, because I could now start to understand how this woman who I loved and adored and worked hard for and sacrificed could feel invisible on a fairly regular basis, even if she's sitting right next to me. And I had to admit, I've done things like that story. To cherish our spouse, we have to choose to actively fight against anything that would make them feel invisible. And I'm going to keep using the word throughout this sermon series of intentionality, because these things don't always just come natural to us. We have to intentionally and thoughtfully choose to cherish. It's a choice, and it's active. If you go out and just simply Google on Amazon, which I did, I typed in the word "the invisible woman," and I wasn't looking for comic books or any superhero stuff. The books that came up spoke about women who felt unnoticed, unseen, invisible. No one cared what they said. Nobody really sought their opinion. They felt unseen. I'll take you back to Song of Solomon again. We read this in Solomon 1:4. "Take me with you." She wanted to be there, but would it have been enough to go with their one and only if the other spouse spent all their time focused on other individuals and had a great time, but you didn't? It continued back in Song of Solomon. "Let me see your face. Let me hear your voice. My lover is mine. I am his." This implies they're being noticed. They're being seen. They're with each other. They're together and connected. "You have captured my heart, my treasure, my bride. You hold it hostage," it said. And when I read those words, "you hold it hostage," I thought that language was interesting. Because when we get married, we choose to give ourselves, our heart, to someone else. And they promise to love us, but also to cherish us. And that holds tremendous power over us. They hold our heart literally hostage. Then they can choose what to do with that power. Not choosing to share moments with our spouse when we're together is hurtful. We might not think of it in this term, but it is a type of emotional abuse. Most of us would define emotional abuse as something like yelling, shouting, screaming, saying cruel things, and all of that's true. But emotional abuse is also withholding love, encouragement, and support from the one we hold their heart hostage. This can be intentionally done by someone purposely not caring for their spouse. In a bad fight, this is called stonewalling, right? When someone is desiring to have a relationship and talk, and someone just shuts them out and closes down communication, that silence itself is hurtful. This hurt can be unintentional. In the examples we just saw, by someone not choosing to make the choice for that includes their spouse. It's reasonable for a spouse who we chose to want and expect us to notice them. It was heartbreaking to me to have to come to realize that I was making my wife feel that way. And that feeling was incredibly motivating for me to want to change that immediately. I had to face the reality that I sometimes did not treat my wife with the same basic attention or honor I would give someone else. For example, if I sit down to counsel a member, I'm engaged. I'm processing. I'm asking follow-up questions. I'm trying to seek to truly understand them. I'm not checking texts. I'm not otherwise multitasking because I know I can't do it. I'm in. I'm there. Do I do that same thing with my wife when I'm with her? Do I ask follow-up questions to really make sure I understand her, her day, her thoughts, her experiences? It hurt my heart when this sank in, because I realized the emptiness that I had caused in my one and only that I love more than anyone else, yet some of my actions, some of my attention, some of the things I was doing wasn't communicating that she was that special, that I delighted in her. In fact, it sometimes communicated the opposite. This can happen to men or women. Again, I'm a husband, so I'm sharing this often through the lens of a male lens, but don't get caught up in that. Please understand these points go both direction. Men and women can both feel this way. I'll try to keep my examples balanced, but I'll probably end up leaning into the husband perspective quite a bit. When a spouse enters a room, all of us want to be noticed and seen. Now, I work from home. I'm often near and around my wife all the time. But I also know about me, I have a very one-track mind. I would continue to, she's now coming to the room, I'm near her. She might even begin talking to me, but I'm working on my laptop. And when she spoke, I'm only half listening at best. I might be able to verbalize if she would ask me what she said, because I have the ability to replay the tape back and say it, but that doesn't mean I was listening. If my phone buzzed with a text from one of you here, I take my job very seriously. I pick out my phone and I'd start responding to the text, and I wanted to be proactive as a pastor and attentive. But all of this was communicating that I didn't cherish my wife. Now, of course, there's time to work, and my wife understands that. She gets that. She supports that. But there's also moments that it's time to shut the laptop. It's time to put the phone down. It's time to give her focus and attention, turning my body language actually to her, my body to her, my eye contact to her, to truly listen, to make sure I'm thinking and processing and asking follow-up questions, to see her, to understand her. And all that communicates she's cherished. Back in Songs of Solomon 7, 9 and 10, I'm not sure we read this before, Song of Solomon 7, 9 and 10, it says, "And the roof of your mouth is like the best wine, the wine that goes down smoothly for my beloved, moving gently the lips of sleepers." And notice verse 10 of Song of Solomon 7. It says, "I am my beloved's, and his desire is toward me." His desire is toward me. He's communicating with his desire, his body language, his eyes, everything, that his desire is for her. If you reach out, or if you look into this word desire, it has this imagery of reaching out for, longing. Well, how do you do that if you're split-brained, if you're multitasking? You can't. You know, this is an added, this is not only physical desire is for his wife, but it was his body language. Everything is communicating, my desire is towards you. We do this again physically, but also with our minds and attention. Now, what about noticing husbands? Now, I noticed today in the room we have no children. So I'm going to talk a little bit about a word that is often through the Bible, but we don't often talk about it. We're going to talk about sex just for a moment. I'm comfortable with it. Hopefully you're comfortable with me talking about it. But if you're not, too bad. All of us. You know, Kathy Myers gave a marriage seminar. I'm going off notes for a second, but she talked about how in her family, you weren't allowed to say that word because of the upbringing culture that came through a family. And, you know, that's the family she came out of. So, anyway, she was sharing that in a marriage seminar. I'm not sure why I decided to share that, but just we're talking about it. The author of Cherish talks about, and I'm going to talk about this for toward wives, but this can go both directions. I'll talk a bit more about that at the end. He asked a group of wives what made them feel cherished. And he said it was like releasing a pack of hounds after an English fox. They had no problem communicating all the things that would make them feel cherished from their husbands. Then he asked men the same question about how they feel cherished. And they looked quizzical, he said. He then learned to ask the question slightly different to men. He says, "What does your wife do that makes you feel special, honored, and noticed?" And the responses that came back from men said, "Well, do you want the PG answer or the real answer?" Because the truth is, for most or a lot of men, I'll just say a large percent of men, is if they are not noticed between the sheets, almost everything else that happens doesn't matter. Now, men, we certainly understand we can help in this process by the way we cherish our wives throughout the entire day leading up to climbing in between the sheets. But my point is, wives, men work really hard. They work hard to earn enough money to make the family budget balance out. They sacrifice. They try to be loving towards you. They're faithful to their marriage vows. They live their lives within Satan's world that is full of constant badgering of sexuality that is off limits for Christians. and a sincere, heavy fight for many men to fight in that world. And it can be helpful to consider that your husband's sexual advances are a request to be faithful to you in both their hearts and minds, and it's also a request to be seen and noticed in a way that makes them feel cherished. And for many men, this can be an area of deep hurt, where they feel invisible and unnoticed, where they feel their heart is held as a hostage, but they are ignored. A husband can feel deeply hurt when a wife who's busy with the many things that occupy her day, maybe 100 different tasks that she needs to complete and responsibilities she has, but all those things can feel to a husband sometimes to come first before him. When a husband feels her job, the laundry, dishes, TV, or anything else is more important than him or comes before him, he can feel very similar to a wife who goes through telling her husband after a long day about this day and all the things to only realize he was half listening the whole time. That's not seeing, that's not noticing our spouse. Now, Gary Thomas wrote in his book that in his experience, that husbands that feel truly cherished by their wives often feel very spoiled in the sexual department. Now, this is a key to really understand about how to cherish our spouse, is to understand that the one who we're trying to cherish is the one who gets to determine how they want to be cherished. That's just how it works. So I'm going to use a different example to teach this principle. How many of you have at some point read The Five Love Languages by Gary Chapman? All right, only about half. Okay, The Five Love Languages, I'm going to need to dive into this just for a second or you'll miss the point I'm trying to make. Five Love Languages basically show how most people have five main ways they're going to communicate and receive love. Those are acts of service. So that would be someone who needs things done out of service for them, and they speak that language. Another one is quality time. That speaks love to some, and they need quality time from others to feel loved. Gift giving, you know, small acts of thoughtfulness where somebody communicates, I was thinking of you, I saw this, it communicated that I thought you would really love this. Words of affirmation, you know, praising someone, telling them how great they are, saying nice things about them. And and the last one, physical touch. Physical touch, you know, and that's not always sexual touch. It can be rubbing their hands through someone's hair or scratching their back or sitting down just right next to them on the couch, communicating, touch. Now, the thing I'm using this to emphasize is if yours is quality time and that's what you need, but your spouse doesn't communicate quality time, they can be buying you gifts. They can be saying nice things. And that might be their love language, is that they're trying to communicate love. But if that's not how you need it, is it going to resonate? Are you going to feel truly loved by that individual? Well, no, they're not meaning not to communicate, but they don't understand, and vice versa. So what I'm saying in that regard to cherish, if you can try all day to cherish somebody in the ways that make you would want to be cherished and you naturally would communicate cherish, but if it doesn't communicate cherish to them, it really doesn't matter. So if you do all these things that your husband you think would appreciate or and make him feel cherished, but you're missing the thing he really is desiring, they're not going to feel that cherished at the end of the day. So that's how I'm going to drive home that point. That's probably enough. But you know, that I was thinking about in sitcoms. My family, we like to watch sitcoms. And this is a moment that I've seen in multiple sitcoms, okay? And I'll speak from my perspective on this. So you have in the sitcom some woman who's waiting all day to be shown she matters. Maybe, it doesn't matter whether it's her anniversary or what in the show, but all day she's waiting. No flowers come. Nothing shows up that is communicating how cherished and special she is. And then the husband finally gets there, and I'm going to make him a husband in the show. Sometimes he's not a husband, but we're going to make him a husband in the show. But the husband gets there, and she's visibly upset, and he says, "What's wrong?" And she says, "Well, you haven't noticed me. You haven't done any of these things." And he says something around this line of, "Well, just wait till we get home. I'm going to give you the best lovemaking of your life," right? And we laugh in the sitcom about that moment because it shows this difference, right? Might communicate Cherish for him, but for her, she's wanting these other things, and he's completely oblivious, and we roll our eyes and we feel that agony, but he's oblivious to it, right? And those moments show us how we can communicate something one way when somebody else is vastly needing something different. You know, in those sitcoms, she feels invisible. She doesn't feel special or honored or seen. I want to then now acknowledge that this isn't just a male perspective. It goes in both directions here. There are marriages where this dynamic is flipped, where the husband's libido is lower than hers, and she feels invisible in much the same way, and he doesn't. So please don't get caught up, if this isn't describing your marriage or it describes it in the opposite way. Don't get caught up in that. Just try to understand the principle. There's a clinical psychologist and professor. His name is Dr. John Gottman. He's really well known for relationship analytics. He talks about how every single day in a relationship, and I'm going to speak about this in marriage, but we make bids. He calls them bids, B-I-D-S, bids for each other's attention. We might say attempts to gain someone's attention. And my wife and I both found this concept helpful. Now, statistically, what a spouse does with these bids or attempts have a huge statistical forecast toward their marriage. So a bid, let's just describe the three types of bids someone can, or actually before I get into that, a bid can be verbal. So a bid could be something asked like, "How was your day?" That could be an attempt to gain attention, to make a bid, or "Would you like a cup of coffee?" Something like that. It's a moment to say, I'm trying to make a connection, right? I'm making a bid, an attempt. It can be nonverbal. It can be just a simple, gentle touch to try to make a connection. Seeking support, such as saying something was difficult or frustrating. It could be playful. A bid could be sending a funny GIF or text to our one and only. It could be physical. It could be leaning in for a hug or sitting down close on the couch, requesting attention. It could be a request for help. Do you have time to do such and such for me? And all of these are types of bids or attempts to share a moment to connect in some way. Now, any spouse that just received a bid or an attempt can do one of three things with it. They can turn toward the attempt or bid. This is responding positively with their body and language. It's showing interest, attention, empathy, engagement. They can also do a second thing. They can turn away. This involves ignoring or missing the bid. And this can be unintentional. This could be me keep working at my laptop instead of listening and giving that attention. I could be, just keep on doing what I'm doing. Or I could respond in some way that really shows what you just said isn't important to me right now. Okay, that's turning away. And then there's the most aggressive, which is turning against. This is an active rejection of the bid. This is responding negatively or irritated. Like, I'm working. Why are you bothering me, right? I just punted that bid, right? So bids are about, do I value what the other person values? Not necessarily because I value it, but because it was important to them and they're trying to take this moment with me. They're my one. Now, what's interesting in Dr. John Gottman's statistics is that couples that turn toward those bids, actively engaged in them, that only caught 33% Couples that got divorced only caught one out of three bids, so 33%. So every time they made an attempt or a bid, they only turned toward it one out of three times. The other times, either they turned away from it or turned against it. Now, I don't want to get too caught up in the stats side of this because I don't think it's important, But what was interesting to me, for a spouse to feel truly cherished, these marriages that were thriving, they caught 86% of bids. That's almost 9 out of 10. And I went, oh no, I'm not catching 9 out of 10 bids. And so that's been a challenge for me to make sure when those bids or attempts for attention, it can be as simple as, oh, look at the bird out the window and I'm working. And, you know, I can think, well, yeah, I'm working on, I got sermons to do. I got Bibles, things to study. I got all, you know, members calling me and all these things. But what's more important, my wife or some project that I'm working on, right? And so I might not care about the bird out the window, but my wife cared enough about it to make an attempt or a bid for my attention. And so it's not about whether I value the bird out the window. It's about whether I value my wife more than anything else. And so that's the point I'm trying to make there. Now, Pam Farrell, she writes a lot of books. She's written like 59 books with her husband. I don't know if they've co-authored all of them, but they write a lot of books, Pam Farrell and her husband. And they often write them on marriage and the family. And she writes about how many women feel most often cherished and loved when the husband simply desires to know more about her, is curious about her. She says, I want to know more, tell me more, gets them very emotionally excited. It communicates that her husband is invested in her, wants to hear more, that she's not boring to him, that he can't get enough of her. One of the keys to this is it's initiated. It's not just listening, it's seeking, it's engagement. I want to know more, tell me more. It's about maintaining curiosity. And I think if all of us think back to the early stages of any relationship of, that we've been in dating, that comes really easy early in dating. Early in dating, you're like, oh, I want to know all about you. Tell me everything. What do you do? How did you feel about that? What's your family like? All, you know, tell me about your life, what you've been through. I want to hear more. I want to hear more. I want to hear more, right? That person's not invisible. That person seems fascinated by you. Those conversations make us come alive in that early dating stage. We knew we mattered. As I work on this in my own marriage, I realize in the busyness of everyday life, I can fail to make sure I'm communicating and continuing that curiosity. Well, tell me more. What was that like? How did that happen? You know, all those different things. And I've had to learn to close my laptop because I can't multitask. If it's still open, I'm going to somehow navigate back to looking at it. But if I close it and turn, I can shift my focus and my interest to her and show and communicate that she's more important. You know, it doesn't matter what big project I'm working on and how important that might be. It's whether I'm communicating to her she's more important than that project or not. That's an attitude I'm trying to work and grow in. Being seen, feeling noticed and cherished is different for each person. For some, if a spouse doesn't call or text and say, I'm on my way home, that might make them feel unimportant and invisible. Whatever it is, each of us want to matter. We want attention. We want to be interesting. And a cherished spouse feels noticed, and an uncherished spouse feels invisible. Number four. We're going to have five today, so this is number four. Protect your spouse. Protect your spouse. Now, if we had a fancy sports car, I'm going to put it in a garage if I can have a garage. I'm going to make sure it's not parked next to the cart corral at Trader Joe's, right, where it can get easily dinged. We do things to protect things that we cherish. Cherishing is about protecting our spouse, about protecting their reputation, who they are, their value. I'll never forget a story from early in our marriage. This is maybe 4 years into our marriage. I think it was right around 2004. We were on a walk, which we like to do. We like to take walks together, Cindy and I, and we were taking a walk, and all of a sudden, this big dog came barreling out the front door of somebody's house 20 feet from us. And I remember without without thinking, I kind of did one of these swooping motions to put myself between the dog and my wife, and I stomped on the ground and I said, no. And the dog locked it up, and it's, you know, it stopped, and the owners came running out, grabbed the dog, apologizing. Now, I would have forgotten this story 5 minutes after it happened. However, what made it always stick in my mind is the way my wife grabbed my arm as we continued to walk and communicated through her body language, I think she actually verbalized it. That was awesome. Like, you protected me. And I remember going, oh yeah? It made me feel good. You know, it made me feel good that she felt honored and cherished. And that was just physical protection, you know, something I did without thinking about it. The dog story was a moment of success, but I've also realized I've had moments of failure because cherishing goes beyond mere physical protection. I've had times I've not protected my wife. I'm going to actually read you a story out of Gary Thomas's book on Cherish, because it tells a story of a man that showed up to him for marital counseling with his wife. And I'm going to read it to you. It says, this is the man. He says, I just want you to know that I was here 6 minutes early, but Rosa was late. I'm sorry. Rosa looked at her husband and said, thanks for throwing me under the bus. The book continues, we've had several meetings before, so it was time to deal with this. Carlos, I said, 5 years from now, you might not even remember my name. Tonight, you're going to go home with Rosa, and I'll go home to my wife, and neither of us will think of each other. The reason you threw Rosa under the bus is because you're worried about what I'm thinking of you. You should be more concerned with what Rosa thinks of you. She's the one you're living with. If you had said, look, Gary, I'm sorry we are late, Rosa would have thought, wow, he protected me. And you'd have a completely, entirely different experience at home tonight. Your job is to honor and protect Rosa because that's who you're going home with, not to impress me. Focus on her. Now, Carlos had the chance, it says, to take the hit for Rosa. And in doing so, he could have made her feel protected and she would have felt cherished. But then the counselor turned to Rosa. Her tardiness had come up several times before, and it was really bugging Carlos. Rosa, you know how you felt when Carlos just threw you under the bus? Yes. That's how he feels every time you make him late to a meeting. He can't not feel that way. He respects being on time. He literally hates being late. So when you make him late, he's going to feel terrible. He can forgive you. He can learn not to throw you under the bus, but he can't stop caring about being late. He just can't. You honor and protect him by working hard to be somewhere on time. In her own way, Rosa wasn't protecting Carlos, end quote. And I thought that story brought out that principle very well. Now, another way that we have to protect our spouses is from our own contempt. Now, contempt is defined by Oxford Languages as the feeling that a person or thing is beneath consideration, worthless, or deserving of scorn. And I've seen this in marriages where they think that person is deserving of their scorn, worthless. We've all heard the phrase, familiarity breeds contempt. There is no relationship we're going to have that is more familiar than marriage. Dr. John Gottman, the stats psychologist that I mentioned before, he believes that contempt is the greatest predictor of divorce. He defines contempt this way, an attitude of superiority as evidence of speaking down to your partner. An attitude of superiority by evidence of you speaking down to your partner. So that, in other words, they see themselves as better. They obsess over faults. Gottman actually talks about what's called a cycle of contempt, or what maybe he calls it that, a cycle of contempt, where contempt builds up over time due to unresolved conflict, unmet needs, and a lack of effective communication. When we start to focus on flaws and imperfections of our spouse, in the absence of understanding, in the absence of grace and a commitment to cherish them, Those flaws and imperfections get under our skin. Those mistakes lead to disappointment in them, and they grow into frustrations that builds into bitterness and eventually to contempt, to devaluing the person, seeing them as more and more worthless over time, deserving of our criticism and disrespect. Now, in Ephesians 4, verse 31, again, not speaking about marriage, but just relationships in general, Ephesians 4, 31, it tells us, let all bitterness, wrath, anger, clamor, and evil speaking be put away from you. These things don't belong in a Christian relationship, in a Christian mind. It says, with all malice. Contempt is a monster, and it gets bigger, it gets hungrier, and it's more destructive. To protect our spouse and our marriage, we have to fight against this cycle of contempt. We can cherish even flawed spouses. James 3 and verse 2 says a very simple phrase. We all stumble in many things. And isn't that true? Don't we all stumble in many things? Don't you stumble in many things? And we need grace and mercy from God our Father, right? We all stumble in many things, not just our spouse. We all do. We all stumble in many ways, and God cherishes us. Cherishing isn't about believing our spouses are perfect, but we can cherish them even in when they stumble, even in, though they stumble in many ways. What areas of our spouse can we praise? What can we still be, even though they stumble in many ways, ways that we can be appreciative and thankful for them? I found this interesting, and I was talking to somebody about it before church. They've done studies that went about what we pick up on depending on whether we're focused on the negative or focused on the positive. When we're focused on criticizing our spouse, you actually only catch 50% of what they do right. So what you're basically saying is they're doing half more things right and you're missing them because you're focused on the negative. You're focused on criticizing them. The same is true on the opposite way. When you are focused on seeing them through a positive lens, seeing their strengths in spite of their flaws, and you're positive towards your spouse, you actually pick up on good things that might not even be there. You actually see even more good than is there. And that's a pretty amazing thing. We need to fight contempt by understanding our spouses are flawed, just as we are, but remembering to focus on how they're amazing, not focus on all their flaws. Lots of studies focus on the connection between gratitude and our happiness level. If we're not thankful for our spouse's great talents and attributes, we're likely very unhappy people. We can grow in happiness in our life simply by cultivating an attitude of gratitude. Now, it's true, there are going to be things about our spouse that we need to talk to them about, problems they have, about issues, about changes we need them to make. But there are approaches we can make in doing this where we still focus on many of the great things they do, how many things we appreciate, but then talk to them about an area that we need them to change. But a pattern of criticism, apart from praise and thankfulness, can lead a spouse to feel demotivated. And all of us have hit moments where in our lives we feel so put down and criticized that we know even if we feel like we're trying to do good, nothing's ever going to be enough. And that's demotivating. Like, that's not going to lead us anywhere good. And we can even feel like quit trying to even do the good we were trying to do, right? Now, I need to add a caveat here. I often caveat certain parts of the sermon. We're certainly not talking about overlooking abuse. We're not talking about overlooking a destructive addiction or enabling that in any way. If that's your situation, obviously there needs to be boundaries put in place. You have to be safe. You need to help get your loved one the help they need to recover. So I won't keep talking about that. That's not the point of this sermon, but I want to just caveat that. Now, I want to talk about another way we protect our spouse in marriage. I talked about before about the early stages of relationships. We often call this the infatuation stage. And all of us will remember those infatuation stages are very exciting. We can't get enough. We can talk for hours. We don't see the flaws and mistakes that are there because we're just so excited about who they are and how much they like us. But anyone who's been married very long knows we move out of the infatuation stage. Infatuation fades. And as it fades and reality sits and sets up more, the blinders to flaws and mistakes come off and we have to begin to fight disappointment and contempt. But the point I'm going to make here is I was recently talking with a young adult, not from this area, about the dangers that lie within marriage when cherishing isn't occurring. When a wife or husband feels invisible, unnoticed, and then all of a sudden somebody else, maybe somebody at work, somebody from the outside, begins to show them attention, to hear them, to ask questions, follows up, shows interest. It stirs something within people that have felt uncherished or invisible, and it can be exciting. It can be intoxicating. And this is a very, very dangerous place for a relationship to be. Even those feelings we understand would too eventually fade and fizzle and wane, but that new intoxication and excitement has led many down bad paths. So for all of us, we guard and protect our spouses and our marriages by a commitment to cherish, to see our spouses, to listen, to engage, to touch, to support, to encourage. And this acts as a form of insulation of our marriage from infidelity. It takes day-by-day work. It takes focus. So we cherish our spouses by protecting them from external dangers like dogs. We cherish them by protecting them from attacks that could come internally. We cultivate gratitude and appreciation and guarding from contempt setting up in our relationship. And we guard our marriages by being the one who cherishes our spouse. And our fifth and final point today is bind your spouse's wounds. Bind your spouse's wounds. We spoke in the first sermon of the series about how God and Jesus Christ bind up our wounds. That was one of our points. Marriage should be a place of safety, of healing, and of peace. I'll recall, I read this in the first sermon, but part one, but Ephesians 5 and verse 29 and also verse 31, Ephesians 5, 29 and 31, said, "For no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it, just as the Lord does the church." And then Paul reminded a verse later, verse 31, "For this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh." When we get married, we become one. That becomes our flesh. It doesn't make literal sense to attack our own flesh. But instead, it said there, we should be nourishing and cherishing that flesh, and that includes that of our spouse. But instead of nourishing and cherishing, spouses often attack their own flesh. We aren't blind. Spouses see the faults of our spouses. But how does God treat us and work within our faults? We all have brokenness. We all have flaws. Some have suffered great brokenness as a direct result of abuse, and that shaped them into adulthood, and that impacts our lives and who we are. These wounds can leave us with areas of vulnerability, areas of low self-esteem. They can impact how we navigate life. And spouses, out of disappointment and frustration, can add further attack and further wounds for what that individual is not. A spouse can be hard on the one that they're literally one flesh with and add further injury. But remember how God, back in Ezekiel 16 from part one, how he approached Jerusalem. He said, "Live, become, be all you can be." Not because she was perfect, but because that's how he wanted what he wanted for her. He saw the potential. Cherishing grows and nurtures our spouse's best parts, their gifts, so they can grow and mature over time. That's what nourishment does. It helps us to grow and mature. Be, become, be all God made you to be. And like Christ, we are called to nourish and cherish the bone of our bone, the flesh of our flesh, to focus on the beauty, the inside and the out, to support them, to encourage them, to live, to live. A cherished spouse wants to also live up to that cherishment. They want to be as you see them to be. It's motivating. And I can tell you as a husband, there is no greater motivation in my life to become and be something than for my wife to praise and talk about that great quality of me. I might even be shocked by it, but I now want to live up to that, right? We all do that. You know, cherishing does something in our heart. It fills a void. It binds our wounds in a way nothing else can. What if we challenged ourselves as spouses to be agents of our spouse's healing? To instead of focusing on holes, on gaps, on brokenness that they have through a negative lens, instead of focusing on that brokenness and their flaws, we saw that brokenness, those holes, those places as places we could step into to bind up, to support, to love, and to heal. An empathetic approach to brokenness with our one. This approach provides medicine of cherishment, of encouragement, of building up. Because I can tell you from experience, and you probably already know this internally, no amount of nagging of tearing down has ever motivated somebody to want to be better. It just doesn't. It just makes us like the other person less. No matter the flaws a spouse has, whether they're emotionally closed off, whether they're overly sensitive to what others think about them, whether they don't like to try new things, whatever we might consider that flaw, what if we first thought, I wonder what impacted them in such a profound way that this is how they've been conditioned to respond? Because in Satan's world, we're told, I cherish you because you're amazing. The idea is you already have to be amazing for me to cherish you. It teaches, I cherish you because you're already excellent, and that cherishment flows out of your excellence. But that's not what the Bible shows how God cherishes. In the Bible, in Ezekiel 16 that we looked at, we saw something very different. It was reversed. It says, your excellence flows out of my cherishing. You will become more and more over time because I'm going to lift you up. I'm going to cherish you in such a profound way. You're going to become excellent. The more you cherish, the more you're going to see things to cherish. All of us as spouses know we have flaws. But don't each of us want spouses that fills our lives with acceptance and affection, where they're our safe place? I'm your one, you're my one, you're my bone, you're my flesh, we are one. I'm thrilled to be yours. I'm thrilled you are mine, flaws and all. You can rest in the peace of my acceptance, and I'll lift you up with my acceptance. My focus won't be on how you're not good enough. I'll pray that God lets the talent and abilities he gave you to shine in your life. I'm not going to compare you to others. I'm not going to cut you down. You're my one. You're my delight. In 25 years of marriage, we've already moved through different phases and new challenges in life. And there are many more challenges we haven't faced that you have. With each new challenge, with each new trial, with each new hurt, new struggle, it's both a challenge, but it's also an opportunity to be a healing agent for our spouse, to bind up wounds and to provide support. Next Sabbath, I'll give the final sermon in this series, and I'm taking four because I believe this is something that is very valuable and needed in marriages. As we close today, let's remember that cherishing is not a luxury in marriage. It is God's design. We are called to cherish and nourish our one, just as we saw in Ephesians 5:29 that Christ cherished and nourished his one, the church. Love is the foundation of sacrifice, of service, of commitment, but cherishes the quality that breathes joy, delight, and life into that foundation. When we cherish our spouse, we see them as our only one. We notice them, we protect them, we lift them up, and we bind their wounds. We become not their critic, but their biggest encourager, their biggest supporter. The Song of Solomon shows us what this looks like. An overflow of delight, of praise, and admiration. It's not about perfection, but it's about daily choosing to see our spouse through the eyes of gratitude and wonder. If your marriage already is thriving, keep it up. Let it shine as a witness to others. If not, take hope. Cherishing can be learned, practiced, and lived out. With God's help, you can move your marriage forward, not just to good, but to great. So let's leave today determined to make our spouses feel seen, honored, delighted in, and cherished.